You're listening to Renegade Broadcasting. Everybody, what do you know? Here I am back up and running again. Been what, a little over 4 months, I guess. A little bit longer than what I expected, but actually, technically, I didn't finish what I was working on, trying to work on, but that's all right. It'll happen anyway, sooner or later. Two things that caused me to take my hiatus. One, my girlfriend, you know, had surgery recently. It wound up being a good month and a half after the time she was supposed to get it. It got postponed because, number one, she got sick. And number two, I think the doctor had to reschedule another time. So there was a bunch of mix-ups on that. And as it turns out, she's still in recovery. It's going to take probably another month or two. I don't know. So I'm home, you know, just for the day. I had to take care of some other stuff too. So I'm home for the show, but I'm probably going to be staying up there. I'll come back intermittently, but for the most part, I'll be staying up there for a while more until she finishes recovering. Also, another reason I took the hiatus, I was hoping to get a YouTube channel started, but that just didn't happen the way I was planning for a couple of reasons, but I'm still going to do it in between while I'm doing a Renegade show, you know, one a week for now anyway. One a week, of course, is, you know, it makes me feel like a dam with the water rising beyond the safety level. Feels like the dam is going to burst. I've got so much material I want to cover. I already had, you know, hundreds of show outlines that I never even broadcast that I had put together a while back. But I've got floating in my head right now at least literally about 100 ideas of stuff that I want to cover. Most of these ideas have come at me in just the past, I don't know, 4 or 5 weeks or so. That's how it works. Sometimes a month will go by and I either get no ideas or maybe only one or two. And when that happens, I forget the whole thing for a while. I just clear my head because I know that eventually there'll be a turnaround. And that's what's been happening the past several weeks. Ideas have been coming at me like wildfire. I just can't read and type fast enough. Some of these ideas come to me while I'm in the shower, while I'm trying to go to sleep, in which case I don't get to sleep sometimes. I'll get up in the middle of the night and my head is racing and I'll just start emailing myself ideas, or I'll start looking stuff up online and then, you know, email myself the links to follow up on later. And I've got some great stuff coming up, folks. Just to wet your whistle, one of the things I'm working on is yet another series on ancient Egypt. Just when you think you've covered it all, oh, no. This is going to blow out of the water all of the previous stuff I've covered. I mean, this is going to come at it from a completely different angle. Well, I shouldn't say completely, but a lot of new ideas, let's put it that way. And nothing that's going to conflict with anything I've presented previously. It's going to complement everything I've said before. But just, I don't want to say any more than that because I'll give it away, but it's just going to be mind blowing. I've got some other stuff. I don't even want to mention it yet because it's just really just incredible stuff. But you just have to stay tuned. Because, though, at least for now, I'm only doing one show a week. I'll ask that, we keep the calls to a minimum because I've just got so much material to cover. I might have to eventually go back to maybe two shows a week. I don't want to do too many, though, because, like I said, I want to get the YouTube thing going. And I am going to be moving. I know I've been talking about that for a while, but it is coming closer. And when that happens, I'll probably have to take a short hiatus, maybe just a few weeks or something until I can get settled in. But that's probably going to be happening. I don't know. Maybe by the summer sometime. I'm not sure yet exactly. But anyway, but I do want to get this YouTube thing going. I actually started the channel. I figured out how to do that. But I haven't uploaded any videos yet. I got a camera. I did manage to do that. Got a pretty good idea how to use it. Not anything complex. My first presentations are going to be very basic, very simple stuff. My editing is just going to consist of hitting the pause button. I'll pick that up as I go along. I realize that you don't really have to be a professional editor to do YouTube videos. There's a lot of people that have been doing YouTube videos for years and really don't even know how to edit. They just hit the pause button. So, what's important is the content of information, not presentation necessarily. You certainly would like to have that too, but I'll pick that up as I go along, little bits and pieces here and there. But like I said, the YouTube channel is going to consist mostly, at least for now anyway, of exposing, that not so holy book there that I love so much. I might do a second YouTube channel. I think I mentioned this before on my explorations in the woods, sharing some of the videos and the pictures and elaborating on the origins of some of these things, which obviously to a great extent go way beyond just quote, Native American stoneworks. A lot of this stuff, of course, is old world cultures having come here thousands of years ago. Celts, the Norse, the Phoenicians, you name it. They were all here at one time or other. And a good many of them came through New England because this was part of the trade route for the copper trade going out to Michigan, where it was mined. So I'll be, I've been presenting a lot of that here on Renegade. I got a lot more stuff too I'll be presenting on Renegade. But so there'll be some overlap, but the good thing with YouTube is I'll be able to include pictures and videos. Whereas on Renegade, you're just getting the audio. But anyway, that's down the line. I'm not sure when I'll get started on that. My first port of call is going to be exposing the Bible. And I'm going to do it, of course, in a more tactful way, I guess, on YouTube. Even though, swearing is allowed on YouTube, I do want to appeal to a general audience more. I want to appeal to a Bible-believing audience. So obviously, I'm going to temper things down on there. There won't be any swearing. I'm going to try to keep it professional. Because I'm hoping to deal a deadly blow to that piece of crap book by reaching the people whose lives are adversely affected by it, which is everybody who believes in it. Bible believers, of course, would never admit that their lives are being adversely affected by the Bible. They think the Bible is a great thing and it's done wonders for them in their lives. They don't realize how much it's held them back, how much it's confused them, how much it's screwed up their worldview. It's adversely affect them in many ways they can't even imagine. So anyway, that's the main audience I want to target with my YouTube my first YouTube channel anyway that I'll be starting out hopefully pretty soon here. Anyway, so a lot of things have happened in the past 4 months, haven't there been? Quite a few things. We've had fake terrorist attacks, particularly what just went on in New Zealand. I don't know if I'm going to be talking about it. I've had some great stuff sent to me, and I've been looking into it, on the side as well. I haven't been able to do too much though, as far as putting notes together, because I met my girlfriend's, and I don't even have a laptop right now. I'm going to be getting one, but I haven't had a laptop, so you can only do so much on your Kindle. You can't type on the darn thing. A minimal amount of typing, but you need a full keyboard. So I'm going to be getting a laptop again, so I can do that. I'll be working on stuff up there. But what I'll be presenting tonight is nothing new. I mentioned all these ideas I've been getting, none of which I've put to onto into any notes yet to share. I'll be doing that in coming weeks. So what I'm going to share tonight and probably next week too, until I can get some of this stuff typed up, is going to be stuff I put together before, but nevertheless, still very interesting. But before I get to that, just a couple more things I wanted to mention. Something else that we've seen transpiring in the past few months. Our wonderful El Presidente has been making some major moves toward what could potentially be World War III. What will inevitably be World War III, as he continues on this path. Shudder to think of it, but where else can it lead, guys? Declaring that illegitimate state in the Middle East, well, declaring its alleged capital as the official capital. Can you frickin' believe that? And as if that wasn't bad enough, just what, 2, 3 weeks ago, he declares Golan Heights to be their property. Can you believe it? First of all, who the hell does he think he is making a statement like that? This man is on such an unbelievable power trip, ladies and gentlemen. But notice on whose behalf he's been working so diligently. Any of you Trump supporters out there, or hopefully former Trump supporters, if you can't see now who this guy really is, who he serves, who he's always served, if you can't see now that you've been duped by the QAnon BS and a few others who, seem on the surface to be decent, but I'm telling you guys, they're either incredibly ignorant, and I really have to wonder about that when you look at the degree of research they've done. I have to question if they're really that ignorant. But in any case, they're either ignorant or they're just outright shills. Just watch out. YouTube is crawling with them. These people that actually think that, I'm not even talking, Christians. There's a lot of Christians doing that, of course. They think this man is God on earth. Jesus, come back in the flesh. But there's even some secular supporters of this slimy little swine ball that are singing his praises. Some of them, yes, on the surface, seem sincere. They've certainly done some good work exposing Shillery Hillary and, the whole Obama slash Pedogate slash, transgender thing. They're doing a good job with that. But then they turn around and are convincing their audience that Trump is the solution. Any minute now, any minute, there's going to be arrests. Indictments have already been handed down. Are you freaking kidding me? I can't believe there's still people touting this BS, and worse yet, there's still people falling for it. And again, I'm talking about people that are supposed to know better. They're supposed to be truthers. People who formally claim to recognize that there's no difference between left and right, Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal, that, that's all the same, just different sides of the same coin. And now they're falling for this from a man who, just give him some time, is going to prove to be probably the worst president yet. Right after the election that put him in office, I remember saying here on Renegade, something major is going to go down with this guy. He's going to wind up being one of the worst yet. And guys, everything that keeps happening with this guy is confirming my worst fears. So I'll have much more to be said about this guy on future shows. I'm putting something together right now, as if enough hasn't been said already. But oh boy, there's something big going down with him and his buddies over there in the Middle East that needs to be exposed. So we'll be talking about that on future shows. I haven't even put those notes together yet, but it's going to be a whopper. This bastard, guys, I'm telling you, watch out. You can smell it in the air. Something big is coming down. Anyway, I'll save that for a future show. Let's see. I think I covered the bases. But yeah, like I said, I've got at least like 100 topics right now swirling around in my head. I can't wait at typing these notes up. Like I said, I've got a huge reserve of topics I haven't even covered yet, and those are all good. I want to get to those, but the stuff that the ideas that I've been getting in just the past few weeks, they have to take priority because this is killer stuff. I just can't wait to, like I said, get this stuff typed up. Amazing discoveries I've been making recently. Anyway, the topic for tonight is something that I put together, I don't know, several months back. It's a compilation of, well, I got the initial idea for it watching some YouTube videos. I don't remember now if somebody shared these with me. I think initially someone had shared one of them with me, and then I dug and found some more. And that's always how it works. You start with one thing and then you just branch off. I got some ideas from a couple books I have, and did some digging here and there. But anyway, pretty fascinating stuff. As I've said before, the Bible, though completely full of crap as far as being a reliable spiritual guidebook, forget that. Nevertheless, it does contain some interesting historical data. Now, even then, you got to watch out. The Bible, even when it's somewhat accurate, it's still loaded with a bunch of BS. You got to learn how to filter out, the fables from the truth. And they always slip that in there, always. With this upcoming Egyptian series, we're going to be looking at it from that perspective. We're going to, sift through to pull out the nuggets of truth. But in doing that, you've got to sift through a lot of garbage. There's a lot of garbage in there, but there are elements of truth. That's how that book works. The story of Jesus is essentially BS. But his life story was borrowed from, as I pointed out many times before, was borrowed from actual personages from the first century, insurrectionists, but nevertheless, their stories are true. So to look at his story, a very interesting picture emerges. You can make sense now, finally, of something that otherwise doesn't make any damn sense unless you're a Bible dupe that doesn't think and just believes what you're told. But you can finally make sense now of the Christian religion, how it started, why it started. You can understand it in its proper context. So even though the story of Jesus is, mostly fiction, most likely the character of Jesus Christ didn't even exist, but yet he did exist in the form of people like, Judas of Galilee or Judas of Gamala, as well as Judas Prestis. Judas Prestis, who was crucified by Pontius Pilate, who preached the coming kingdom of God, preached repentance. Striking parallels. And even the name, guys, is almost precisely the same. Instead of Christos, it's Krestos. Isn't that interesting? So much of the story of the life of Jesus is true. It did happen, not under the name Jesus Christ, but you understand what I'm saying. It is important to study these books. Yeah, it is very important. Even though it's mostly garbage, don't throw it out. Oh, some very interesting insights are provided for us, for helping us to understand the tribe, how they work, how they have infiltrated societies. It's all in there. And when I do my series, upcoming series on ancient Egypt again, this new series, we're going to be looking at some very interesting biblical passages that provide some very important insights that you're really going to be amazed about. Anyway, so in this current set of notes that I want to cover tonight, we're going to be doing that. We're going to look at the Bible as history, and even though a lot of this story has been fabricated and hyperbolized, nevertheless, the essential elements of the thing are true. Just like the biblical flood. In fact, that was a topic that I originally was going to talk about tonight, but that's a whole series. It's like six, seven parts, and that would probably take the whole month of April to cover. So I figured I've covered that before years ago. Some of you remember back on Oracle, but I never talked about it here on Renegade. I might have touched on it a little bit here and there, but at some point I do want to repeat that series. It's absolutely fascinating. It's one of my favorite topics, ancient catastrophism, and the idea of this global scale flood. I hate to even use that term because when you do that, people think you're talking about what the Bible says. It wasn't just a flood. It was much more than that. There was a global scale inundation, but it involved massive upheavals of the Earth's crust, volcanic eruptions, huge storm systems occurring on a global scale, tidal waves and hurricanes. And I mean, the Earth was a shambles. It's amazing that there were any survivors, but you can't deny it when you look at all the evidence. First, you have, of course, ancient legends from around the world that talk about it. There's over 80 of them worldwide. The Babylonians, the Sumerians, the Egyptians, the Romans, the Greeks, the Maya. Many North American native tribes talk about it. The ancient Mahabharata from India, the Orient, a lot of Chinese legends talk about this. But you also have, of course, paleontological evidence, the fossil record. You get geological evidence, on and on it goes. So I'll cover that again sometime. But believe it or not, the Bible, as full of crap as it is, and even though the biblical story of the flood is largely BS, there are actually some very interesting elements in the biblical story that aren't found in a lot of the other legends around the world that clue us in on some important aspects of that disaster. So, like I said, I'll cover that in a future time. Anyway, with no further ado, let's get into our topic for tonight. When the Bible describes historical events, as I said, usually they have an element of truth to them, but it's sometimes hard to figure out what these stories represent since they're often loaded with, once again, exaggerations, hyperbole, and just outright lies, fantasies. One example of this is the story of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. There was a Sodom, there was a Gomorrah, and they were destroyed. There's actually archaeological evidence of that. And a lot of people think that because you don't see any ancient remains in the area of the Dead Sea, that the remains must be, buried under the Dead Sea. And, so that's the claim that's often made. The reason why we haven't found it, it's because it must be in the Dead Sea. These cities, after they were destroyed, they got flooded out by the Dead Sea. And so, we'll probably never be able to find them. The water's too salty. We can't get at those depths. It's too murky, or whatever excuse they provide. But no, that's not true. What I'm going to present tonight is it just blew me away when I saw this. I had no idea. The remains of those cities. And it wasn't just Sodom and Gomorrah. There were actually five cities. ADMA is another one. There were actually a total of five cities in this area that we're told were destroyed. Now, of course, the Bible would have us believe that the great Yah monster sent fire and brimstone from heaven. Yeah, whatever. Just like the flood. Yahweh did it because everybody was naughty. So I'll kill everybody, including little babies, because I'm ticked off. Shut up. Nevertheless, there was a flood. So when the Bible talks about this flood, yes, it did occur, not for the reasons the Bible gives, but it did occur. So it is with Sodom and Gomorrah. There were cities in the area of the Dead Sea. They're not buried under the Dead Sea today. They've been right there all along, staring us in the face, right in the area of the Dead Sea, above water, not in the depths of the Dead Sea, above water, right there in plain sight. Amazing. We'll get into that in more detail in a moment here. But anyway, so yes, these calamities did take place, but as always, in classic Bible fashion, the biblical authors came along, took a story that had truth to it, and flavored it up and made it out like their God was behind the destruction. You can go through pretty much every story in the Bible, and that's what's going on. Whenever there was a war, they attributed it, a war that they won, and they won it because they hired mercenaries to do their fighting for them. But nevertheless, whenever there was a battle that they won, they would attribute it to their great God giving them victory. And they made their God out to be a warmonger. Well, if they do have a God, if he does exist, he's a warmonger, all right. Oh, he loves it. And you could make the case that he's been empowering them for thousands of years on end to instigate every freaking war in our history, funding them, instigating them, and profiteering politically as well as financially off of them. So, yeah, if that thing does exist, oh, he loves war, all right. And he did reward them. I guess we can believe that part. But as far as destruction is like from Sodom and Gomorrah, guys, it can be shown that they did not come at the hand of God. And we'll be getting into detail on how that actually happened later on. So anyway, so for the guys, get this review back.
A band is blowing Dixie, double fall time. You feel alright when you hear the music ring. Well, now you step inside, but you don't see too many faces. Coming in out of the rain, they hear the jazz go down. Competition in other places.
This is an important message on behalf of the WHO, the World Health Organization. It has come to our attention that various neo-Nazi groups are trying to promote natural, healthy, alternative products to white people. The Rockefeller Foundation didn't spend billions of dollars in creating the synthetic and safe medical and pharmaceutical industries, so some far-right startup like heathenherbs.com, to name but one, can now destroy over 100 years of testing on humans and other animals. Your painful death today helps us treat black, brown, and yellow children tomorrow. Thank you.
Hey, mama said the way you move gonna make you sweat, gonna make you groove. Away.
out, guys. Welcome back. So let me stop my rambling and let's get into the thicket of this here. When we look at the Dead Sea area, where these cities were once located, we do see signs of grand-scale ancient devastation. It's a wasteland, not just because of the salt. Obviously, the Dead Sea prevents life from flourishing there. But no, there's other indications of a calamity having occurred there in ancient times. But what was the nature, or should I say the cause, of this devastation? It leveled whole cities, five whole cities. Was it the great Yah monster, the fire-breathing dragon, as the Bible says? Or was it something more down to earth that was merely attributed to that dragon? I said, if that thing exists, devastation is right up his alley. But this devastation, as we're going to see, did have more earthly causes behind it. Let's begin by looking at the biblical description of this devastation. Genesis 19, verses 24 to 28, gives us an account of what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah and the other three cities were also wiped out. It says, Then the Lord rained down burning sulfur on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of the heavens. Thus he overthrew these cities and the entire plain, destroying all those living in the cities and also the vegetation in the land. But Lot's wife looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. Yeah, whatever. You got to love that one. Not only is this monster throwing a temper tantrum, like the flood, right? Supposedly. Wiping everything out because he's ticked off. They're not doing what I say when I say how I say. But now, here it is, generations after this flood disaster. He doesn't like Sodom and Gomorrah and the three other cities. So he decides to destroy them too. He didn't learn his lesson that destruction doesn't stop the sin problem. Seriously, think about it. That alone is reason enough to start questioning this nonsense book. But nevertheless, now we see that Lot's wife, supposedly, was turned into a pillar of salt. And why? Because she was told not to look back, and yet she stopped and looked back. We're supposed to believe that this was divine intervention here that turned her into salt to teach her a lesson. You weren't supposed to look back. Again, guys, what I see here is there probably is some truth to the story that this woman, if there was such a woman called Lot's wife, whatever, there may have been several people that this happened to, but it doesn't matter. What probably happened was there was a tremendous amount of heat involved in the destruction of these cities, and I'll get to that later, what I think that was. But there is a lot of evidence that these cities were burned with tremendous amounts of heat that melted stone. Her stopping and looking back probably turned her to ash. She probably got burned right there on the spot. And they called it salt because it looked white like the salt in the area. So you can see that even though the story is ridiculous, it's obviously a fairy tale. You can also see, some elements of truth to it, that they just flavored it up. All ancient legends did this, by the way, not just in our little not-so-holy book here. All ancient legends did this. And so what they were doing, the biblical authors, they were just copying what everybody else was doing. They took real stories and flavored them up to suit their fancy. Of course, when the biblical authors did it to manipulate people, to exploit them. And they're still doing it with that book, aren't they? So there's a big difference between what they were doing and what other ancient cultures did. When other ancient cultures flavored their stories, they didn't do it to manipulate. They didn't do it to exploit. They did it to teach lessons. Usually, those stories were passed on to, the grandkids, right? To teach important lessons. And the grandkids knew that the stories were filled with hyperbole, but they didn't care. It's like my grandfather used to do the same thing. I used to love the stories he told me. I knew most of it didn't happen the way he told me, but it was fun to listen to. And there was always, a moral to it or some lesson he would draw from it, whatever. That's how ancient legends work. But not when it comes to the tribe, guys. No. Their stories, again, were designed to manipulate, to exploit, to pilfer. Anyway, finishing up this Genesis passage, Lot's wife looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. Early the next morning, Abraham got up and returned to the place where he had stood before the Lord. He looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah, toward all the land of the plain, and he saw dense smoke rising from the land, like smoke from a furnace. So there you go. Bible confirms that these destructions did indeed involve tremendous heat. Was it from the great Yah, the fire-breathing dragon, or was there something else going on? Oh, there was something going on, all right. We do have evidence that there were cities there, and they were subjected to tremendous heat. What was this heat? What was the source of it? We'll be getting into that later. Forget that it was Yahweh. Although, like I said, if that thing exists, that would be right up his alley, wouldn't it? The little fire-breathing dragon that he is. But no, we can come up with a much more sound, sober, earthly explanation for what happened there. There was a fiery destruction of five cities in the Dead Sea area in ancient times. There's no question. We'll be looking at the evidence of that. So what the Bible says here, to some degree, is true. Burning sulfur rained down from the sky, says the biblical record. Lot's wife, quote, turned into a pillar of salt, i.e., she was vaporized, essentially, and turned to a pile of ash. That's how tremendous this heat was. The next morning, it says, there was nothing to be seen except dense smoke as from a furnace. Notice how Abraham went and overlooked this city. Was Abraham licking his chops that a victory was won over these cities? One of the shows I have coming up in the Ancient Egyptian series, it's going to open with a discussion of Mr. Abraham. I've never actually dealt with him in any significant detail before. I've talked about him in passing, but wait till you see what's coming up on him. And I marvel that I never really went into any significant detail with him before, guys, because it all started with that bastard. It all started with him. He was the very first tribal bastard that got the whole ball rolling. Anyway, I won't say any more. I'll save that for later. But oh boy, oh boy. Wait till you see what's coming up with him. Anyway, so what exactly went on here? Biblical record, as we're going to see, as far as the story of the incineration of five cities, is true. It did happen. We can see the evidence of that. But what exactly went on there? It sounds like it could have been, you know, either a volcanic eruption, except, of course, there aren't any volcanoes in the area. Here, the Sea of near the Dead Sea. I have Sea of Galilee here. How did that happen? Dead Sea. Must have been half asleep when I wrote these notes. Near the Dead Sea, there are, of course, thick layers of volcanic rock, but these resulted from a breaching of the crust that caused magma, you know, to flow from beneath the Earth's crust, but not as violent eruptions. It just oozed out of the breached crust, much like what you have in what's called the Deccan Plateau in India. There's thousands of square miles of massive amounts of lava that spewed out of the Earth's crust in the distant past, but only because the Earth's crust was breached. Probably happened very gradual, not a violent eruption. The Earth's crust was breached, and this magma just oozed out, probably slow enough that you could outrun it. But it ultimately engulfed, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of square miles. I forget now how big the Deccan Plaza is. It's huge, though. But there's no volcanoes around. This lava did not result from a volcanic eruption. It was a slow oozing out of you know, liquid rock. And so that's what you have here in the Dead Sea area. There is lava, but not from violent volcanic eruption. So that lava did not result. It probably predates the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Even if it doesn't predate it, if it postdate, it doesn't matter. It wasn't connected with what we know took place there. What took place there was a violent event that caused these cities to be incinerated, caused stone to melt. Debris was sent flying in every direction. There was, quote, fire raining down from heaven, if you will, but not of a volcanic nature. Like I said, again, there's no volcanoes anywhere to be found. Anyway, there are a lot of sulfur deposits in the Dead Sea area, but again, not from a large erupting volcano. While there are actually pillars of salt near the Dead Sea, clearly Lot's wife did not turn into one of these. Completely ridiculous. But, you know, like I said, what probably happened, she might have been incinerated by the intense heat, her and probably many other people. And so because there's so many pillars of salt in the area, they just made the story up. You can just see how this crap was just, you know, invented. You know, legends get started. And then after a while, because it winds up in a holy book, these legends become sacred stories now. And if you question it, why, you're blaspheming. Isn't it amazing, guys? Thousands of years later, we're looking at, you know, probably about 4,000 years ago when this happened. And you still got people today believing that, my God, multiplied millions of them are believing that these stories actually happened exactly the way we're told. Well, they happen to some degree, yes, but not the way we're told. Pretty pathetic. But anyways, if the force that destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah wasn't a volcano, then what exactly could it have been? Well, let's look at some more interesting features around the Dead Sea. We already mentioned there is sulfur, just as the record states in the book of Genesis. In fact, balls of sulfur have been found, lots of balls of sulfur. Sulfur doesn't form in balls naturally on its own. What caused this? It's believed by many people that, as I said before, that the remains of Sodom and Gomorrah are now beneath the Dead Sea. But again, that simply is not true. They are, in fact, right there out in the open, but have eluded most people because they were damaged almost beyond recognition by the disaster that devastated the area. In this region are stone bluffs, or these outcroppings all across the desert floor, or buttes, you might call them, B-U-T-T-E-S. Just these huge stone outcroppings. And at first glance, they look like what you see in the American Southwest. They look like natural formations that resulted from erosion, where at one time, these stone outcroppings were sand that had later turned to stone, and parts of that original formation had worn away, leaving other parts behind. But that's not what these outcroppings are in the Dead Sea area. If you look at them carefully, and, you know, just you can Google this. There's plenty of videos on YouTube about this. Just look up, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah found, you know, you'll see some of what I'm talking about. It's absolutely fascinating because when you look at these stone outcroppings, they actually contain perfectly squared off and rectangular shaped indents indicating that they were once either doorways or windows that had filled in with debris and hardened into stone. But these rectangular formations clearly were once doors and windows. Some of these buttes have, you know, triangular points to them, or rounded off tops that look like, you know, ancient towers, or you know, gabled roofs that were encrusted over by falling debris, red hot sulfur, and other melted stone and ash. You can analyze, and there has been a lot of analysis done with this material, which shows that yes, it was once subjected to tremendous heat. It was, you know, molten rock, sulfur mixed with ash and other materials that vitrified. So these buttes, once again, are not natural outcroppings. Upon close inspection, they are the remains of literally petrified ancient buildings strewn all across the Dead Sea area. Absolutely fascinating. When I first started watching these videos, I couldn't believe it. I'm like, my God, yeah, it's so obvious. The doorways go right to ground level, and they are high enough, just the right height to have been doorways, you know, 7-8 feet tall, enough for an average person to walk through, just like modern doorways, right? And they have rectangular, you know, windows that are equidistantly spaced all around. They're buildings, or the remains of buildings. But they were so subjected to such tremendous heat that, you know, you can't dig through the layers and find the buildings because they were, you know, vitrified. But enough of their shape remained, having been encrusted with this tremendous heated material, that you can still discern their original shape. But the buildings themselves have, you know, been turned to ash and then petrified later. You've got to see these videos to really fully appreciate what I'm saying. For me to describe it isn't enough. You have to see this. If you haven't, if you have seen this, you know what I'm talking about. You can appreciate this. If you haven't, you got to Google this, or, you know, go on YouTube or whatever. There's quite a few videos on this. You know, you might want to turn the volume down, because you're going to probably most of the time hear nothing but Bible BS being shoved down your throat. Bible believers love this. They think it, you know, legitimizes their holy book. But nevertheless, you know, you can certainly appreciate the video part of it. Fascinating stuff. Yes, there were cities there. These ruins, and that's what they are, they're ruins, are extensive. They go on for quite a few miles. So you can tell, yeah, there were five cities, just as described, that were in close proximity to each other. And, you know, all you see is, again, the remains of what were once stone buildings. Because the stone, even though it vitrified, it melted, it was strong enough to at least have had their original shapes preserved. Everything else would have been incinerated, right? So you don't see any human remains. You don't see really any signs of pottery and whatnot. That stuff had a much lower melting point, so not enough of it remained intact to be preserved. You know what I'm saying? Although we might yet, if any archaeological digs are done there, no one's really done anything there because they don't think anybody ever lived there. I'm sure in the future, if any serious work is done there, they probably will find stuff buried underground indicating a huge presence there at one time, thousands of years ago. But in any case, what we can see above ground, the remains of these ancient buildings, is absolutely astonishing and undeniable. Anyway, I kind of went ahead of myself, so let me backstep here. I hope there isn't too much overlap, but I don't want to skip any of these details here. You can see swirly patterns all throughout these structures, showing that they were once in liquid form and then later had hardened as it cooled. A tremendous amount of heat would obviously have been required to do this, to produce these swirly patterns. You can see that it was once, you know, soft material that later hardened. Other adjacent cliff sides nearby, upon close inspection, reveal faint hints of, like I said, of the sides of buildings that were completely engulfed in the same swirly molten material that rained down on these ancient ruins, you can still see traces of perfectly squared off inundations, like I said, you know, that were once windows, doors of structures, the facades of buildings. You can tell that some of them had very fancy entryways, not just plain doors, but, you know, they had lintels above. There must have been some carvings there because you can see faint traces of handiwork. It's just incredible, guys. This stuff, again, has eluded most people, even a lot of scientists, because it's amazing. If you're not looking for something, you tend to not know it's there. And that's how it is with these cliffs. If you just glance at them, you won't think twice about them. But once you consider the possibility that, you know, these were ancient buildings, now it jumps out at you such that you can't see them as just, you know, natural outcroppings anymore. Funny how the human mind works. It's that way with a lot of things, isn't it? When you're not clued into the fact that your government is run by lying, murderous thieves, you tend to believe the BS you see in the news, right? Most people do. They don't question it. Once you see this system for what it is and you know who's running it, you know that everything that comes over the airwaves is BS, right? It's so obvious to us who have studied this and know how it works. But to the untrained eye and ear, they don't see it. They don't hear it. It just goes wee right over their heads. And that's what they depend on, right? Well, so it is with these cliffs I'm describing. They're not natural. Once you are clued into what you're really looking at, bang, it jumps out at you and you marvel that you never saw it before. These ruins literally look like petrified or better yet, vitrified buildings. And that's really what they are. Other nearby cliffs show much erosion, yet there are still discernible geometric shapes that hint at ancient fortified city walls. Some of these structures look like they were fortresses, which you would expect. These were cities, right? They would have had, a military to defend them. So, yeah, some of them look like very well-fortified forts, or what used to be well-fortified forts, but now are completely encased in a thick layer of fallen, molten debris that encased them. So, as an analogy, you could consider the ruins in ancient Pompeii, right? They were engulfed by falling ash and debris. And as scientists have gone in and excavated by chipping away at this debris, now there we have mostly ash that inundated the city. A lot of people just died from suffocation. It wasn't even heat from the volcano necessarily. Only those that were the closest to the volcano died from the heat. Still others further out died from the heat of the ash itself. But then there were still others further away from that by the time the ash got to them, it wasn't that hot enough to kill them from the heat, but it suffocated them. It buried them alive. So when they come in, all they have to do is just brush away the layer of ash. Sometimes it's hard and encrusted. In other cases, it's very soft and easy to move away with a brush. Anyway, so that's my point in what we're dealing with here. These are ruins that were encased in ash, but this ash, for the most part anyway, was intensely hot all around because you can see signs that all of these buildings melted. So again, this isn't a volcano, not only because there aren't any volcanoes visible, but we don't see any sign that buildings further out weren't subjected to as much heat because it's further away from the source. A lot of that ash having, you know, cooled off as it reached further locations, like what you have with Vesuvius. All of these structures clearly were vitrified, were melted. So the heat was intense across the board. This was no ordinary heat. You won't even get this from a volcanic eruption, folks. Across many miles, all of these buildings show signs of being exposed to tremendous heat that didn't cool off as it spread. So this was no ordinary heat. What kind of heat are we talking here? It's something incredible, right? Well, again, we'll get to that later. I'm going to get ahead of myself. There are even some pyramidal-shaped structures along with some other pyramidal shapes hinted, you know, like ziggurat type structures. There are also square and rectangular edifices with high walls and slit-like indentations that were clearly once windows. Again, these were probably fortified structures having slit windows so that you could see out, but outside attackers wouldn't be able to fire their arrows through so easily because they're so narrow. A lot of medieval castles were built that same way. These features, again, look like they were once defensive fortresses. These walls are pockmarked with a great many deep pits or holes. Were these caused by powerful blasts that sent debris flying in every direction at great velocities? That's certainly what it looks like to me. There was debris flying. We know this not only from what, you know, the biblical description gives us, but from a lot of the physical evidence, more of which we'll be getting into here shortly. Obviously, these were man-made structures that are simply encased, once again, in formerly molten debris that fell on them from above. The type of sulfur found in the Dead Sea area is not the type that is found in its natural state. It has a white color to it instead of yellow, indicating that it was once heated to a very high temperature. In fact, I think white is the temperature that results from the strongest heat. There's, you know, there's red, there's yellow, there's orange, and then white. White is the final stage of when sulfur reaches its peak temperature. So that again indicates that the sulfur was not molten, but it was technically cemented. All right, guys, let's short break. Right back.
Rabbi Steve Gutel, who was president and CEO of the Jewish Council for Public Affairs.
There are two issues at the top of our agenda at the very moment. One is the unbelievably important immigration debate in this country, to make sure that immigrants from around the world, particularly those from south of our border, have a chance here.
And here's an interview with Rabbi Goldschmidt.
Essentially, what you're saying is that in this boat, you're together with both Muslims
yes.
And people of other denominations.
And we see ourselves together, fighting together with our Muslim brothers.
Thanks, Jews.
Thank you. Renegade Broadcasting, hard-hitting talk radio.
Everybody, welcome back. So, as I was saying before the break, this white sulfur, just by the color alone, indicates that it was once subjected to tremendous heat. But sure enough, chemical analysis confirms that it was indeed once, was exposed to tremendous heat because of the structure of it, the way it's crystallized. So again, we have to ask, what produced this tremendous heat to cause this sulfur to melt like this, to be, essentially vaporized? Before continuing, it looks like I got someone on the line. I think it's Brian. Is that you, Brian?
Yes, it is.
Hey, how
it
that
isn't
guy,
an April Fool's Day joke.
Yeah, right.
Is back on the air.
The April Fool is back.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I'm looking at your schedule. Are you just going to be doing Mondays, or are you possibly going to be doing more than one time slot?
Yeah, I was talking about that earlier. I might eventually have to, because I got so much material I want to cover, and this is going to be a tease, just one show a week. So if Kyle has, openings and whatever, I might actually be doing that. But yeah. For now, anyways, one show a week, because I don't know if you caught me at the beginning of the show. My girlfriend is still recovering from her surgery.
Ooh.
So I don't want to be away for more than one night at a time, for now. She can't lift anything more than like 10 pounds, or she can't do laundry or anything like that.
Oh, that's sad. What did she have?
She had a hernia.
Oh.
But it got worse. And the surgery got delayed because she got sick. And of course, in the process, it got worse. It tore more. Ah. She has an ailing mother in her senior years too. So she was having to help her. And of course, doing that made it worse. She was having to lift her luckily right now her mother's staying with her sister, so she doesn't have to deal.
Sounds good. Well, let's hope for a speedy recovery from her, for her. Charles, of course, inquiring minds need to know, what made you decide to come back to Renegade?
I had mentioned I was going to come back, I just didn't know when. I another reason I left too is I wanted to get a YouTube channel started. That didn't quite happen the way I was planning, but I did start one. I mean, I have it registered and everything. I just haven't put any videos up yet, but I do hope to be doing that in the near future.
That sounds wonderful.
Of course, I won't be talking about our tribal friends so much, because I'll be shut down the same day I start.
Yeah, because we know who controls YouTube. Exactly.
Oh, yeah. But nevertheless, I'll still get important messages out on there. I want to talk about the friggin' Bible. So far, from what I can tell, they won't shut you down for that.
Well, you know what? I just don't want to interrupt your show. I just want to say congratulations, welcome back, because you were dearly missed over the air, and it's nice to have a voice of reason back on.
Yeah, well, that's another thing that brought me back a little sooner too. I've been having a lot of people getting impatient, like get off the pot, hurry up, type of thing. And so I said, yeah, it's time. Plus, I've been having so many show ideas come at me. I've got so many things I want to cover, man. I can't wait to get to it.
Yeah,
it's the kind of stuff you can't. What's that?
Oh, sorry. Sorry, I was just going to say, when you get around to talking about the fraudulent NASA missions, I've got a slew of new material that I've got.
Oh, yeah, same here, same here. Hey, I don't know if you read the magazine New Dawn. Excuse me, New Dawn. Have you ever heard of it? It's out of Australia.
I've heard of it, but I've never read it, no.
Yeah, well, they have an article this month. It's a bi-monthly thing, but the latest issue, anyway, has a really good article in there with, I guess, some new material that's just recently been investigated, debunking the Apollo thing. So I'm dying to read that, and I'll be sharing that. So, yeah, feel free to chime in.
I'll look it up because, like I said, I would like to see what they have discovered.
They do have some good stuff in there. It's pretty good. It's up there with, what's that other one, Atlantis Rising. Did you ever hear that one?
Yeah, I've heard of Atlantis Rising. Yeah.
Yeah, it's along that same line. Pretty good.
Anyway, but I don't want to interrupt your show because it's a good show, because I'm glad you're talking about real history. And, of course, I know you're getting around to the fact that the sulfur is white due to a nuclear explosion in our ancient past.
Yeah, that's where I'm going.
Exactly. So I don't want to ruin it. I don't want to do a spoiler alert. So I'll listen to the rest of the show, and I'll keep in touch with you, old buddy. Nice to have you back.
You bet. Hey, thanks for calling.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Yeah, take care. Anyway, I hope I gave him the right name. It's New Dawn. I think I said New Dawn. Yeah, New Dawn magazine. It's very good. That one, I, and again, Atlantis Rising, and what's the other one I like? Nexus, too. Interestingly, I think all three of them are out of Australia. That's interesting, but... Yeah, they're all really good. I've gotten actually a lot of good ideas from them over the years, the shows. Anyway, and then, you know, they talk about all kinds of alternative stuff and alternative medicine, health. They've even mentioned sometimes the J factor, not too aggressively, but, you know, they've covered that pretty well. I guess the best you can for a magazine that appeals to somewhat to mainstream. I mean, they're carried by, you know, Barnes and Noble and whatnot. So I suppose if I was going to do a magazine like that, I would probably address that issue the same way they've done. You know what I mean? Or you're never going to sell the damn thing. That's how it works. Anyway, getting back to the discussion. So what caused this tremendous heat? We've already ruled out volcanism. It came from the sky. What was the nature of it? Well, like Brian just implied, it appears, guys, it was some type of ancient warfare technology. Now, before I even continue, I got to mention again, we've already seen that Abraham played into this, right? Kind of getting ahead of myself, but so I wish I had my Abraham notes done, you know, right now and started with that show. Should have done that in the reverse order. But anyways, where do you see what a scoundrel Mr. Abraham was? Oh, he was a bastard, ladies and gentlemen. He was a friggin' monster. He started the whole thing going. If you're going to look back and nail it on one person and blame him as the single most responsible scoundrel for starting the whole tribal push for world domination, it's him right there. Look no further. Him. I'm not saying he's the first tribe member ever, although biblically speaking, he was. He's certainly the one that got the whole ball rolling with the dream of global domination. But yeah, undoubtedly, there were others before him. But he is the very first one to have gotten the ball rolling, to have gotten this whole idea, pushed forward. Like I said, we'll get into him later. I got a lot to say about him. A lot of new stuff I never even knew before until just past few weeks or so. Can't wait to share this stuff. It's probably going to take several shows just to cover that bastard. You won't believe, even though there isn't a hell of a lot said about him in the book of Genesis, there's enough that you can really expand and elaborate. You'll see what I mean. We'll get to that later. But anyways, the fact that he's mentioned here in the context of this Sodom and Gomorrah story, you can bet your sweet fat fanny that he played a role in this. If, in fact, as I'm going to suggest and be documenting, If, in fact, we're dealing with some type of ancient high-tech weaponry that was used on these cities, you can bet your sweet fanny that Mr. Abraham played a big role in this. Now, of course, the Not-So-Holy Book isn't going to tell you that, but it gives hints in that direction that I won't be getting into in this show. Quite frankly, when I put these notes together months ago, I wasn't even aware of some of the things that have recently come to my attention regarding Mr. Abraham. So, you know, I wouldn't have mentioned it in these notes anyway. But later, when I talk about Abraham, this set of notes will have even greater meaning when you see that Abraham was, you know, involved at all in this. He was involved, so says the Bible itself. But again, he was involved to a much greater degree, I'll argue, than what the Bible's ever let on. But anyways, nevertheless, not far from the Dead Sea, there exists an oval-shaped crater that measures roughly 5 kilometers in diameter. On the edge of this crater are found numerous what are called fulgurite formations. Now, fulgurites are like rocks I have since I was a kid, so I've got some of these in my collection. Glitch I had to fix. Fulgurites are formed, they can be formed by man's hand too in more modern times. But prior to the modern rediscovery, I have to say rediscovery, of electricity, the ancients knew about electricity. There's no question about it. They used it, guys. The Baghdad battery alone proves that, which now has disappeared, of course, since 2003 when they raided the frickin' Baghdad Museum. But there's no question the ancients knew about and utilized electricity to do such things as electroplating jewelry and probably quite a few other applications. But we know that they did make use of it, no question. So anyway, but, you know, in more earlier ages preceding the 18th century, before little Benny Boy Franklin, who's falsely attributed to being the discoverer of electricity. No, guys, he was just well-connected. They gave that to him, just like they gave relativity to Einstein, which is BS anyway. But, you know, they made him a genius. He was no freaking genius, as you well know. So anyway, but what fulgurites are is superheated vitrified sand that has been fused together by the heat it was subjected to by strikes of electricity or lightning. But in more modern times, fulgurites have been created by, you know, tension wires that fall. And when they get exposed to the local sand or dirt or whatever, the current going through the dirt actually vitrifies the soil and solidifies it, so that you get this branched out pattern of rock that, again, was previously sand or dirt. It's now rock, and it's hollow in the middle from where the lightning bolt actually, or the current of electricity traveled through the thing. But in the Dead Sea area, right in the region where this big crater is, they have found these huge fulgurites. Fulgurites caused by electricity or by even lightning strikes are usually fairly small. You know, the piece I have is only about maybe half an inch wide. They can be very lengthy, you know, several feet long or whatever, but they're usually very narrow, you know, half an inch, usually not more than an inch. But these fulgurites are huge. So we're talking a very powerful current that passed through the soil. And I would argue it corresponds with the destruction of these cities, the remains of which can only be seen by these, you know, these bluffs sticking up that look like cliffs until you train your eye and realize, oh my God, wait a minute, these are actually vitrified and petrified ancient buildings. So the event that vitrified these ancient buildings must obviously have been the same event that caused this crater and that caused these huge fulgurites. Powerful currents were sent out that melted the native soil and created these features that are many times larger, some of them, you know, as wide as your hand. What kind of powerful current was being dispersed that could have melted? You don't find fulgurites this size. You just don't. From natural occurrences. This was something beyond natural that went on here to cause these. It melted and fused sand and rock together in finger-like shapes, but very large fingers, in the form of, large hollow tubes. They're not the result of lightning, like I said. These features were caused by something of much greater force, much greater power. They formed from a tremendous blast in the distant past, the same force again that caused this crater and that resulted in these buildings being vitrified and incinerated. They are also much much larger, like I said, than normal fulgurites. Usually they're only 6 or 7 inches long. Sometimes they can be a couple feet. But these features are as large as tree trunks in some cases. They're 6, 7, 8, 10 feet long, and they're a good foot and a half, sometimes 2 feet wide. Mainstream science pretty much ignores these. I don't even know if they offer any kind of theory to try to explain them. If they do, it's BS. Nothing that they can come up with can explain this. So generally, they just ignore it. They don't even deal with it. Just like they don't deal with so much evidence of pre-Columbian contacts with the Americas. They just ignore it, completely ignore it. Once in a while, on rare occasion, they will mention the famous Olmec stone heads that depict obvious Africans, Negroes. They ignore it. On the rare occasion that they do mention it, they'll just say that some believe that these heads present evidence of contact with Africans before Columbus. After all, they do look like Africans. That's all they'll say. I have a textbook in the other room from my college days that actually makes that very claim. They don't say that it's proof of African contact. They'll just say that some think because they do look like Africans. Well, God damn it, of course they look like Africans because they are Africans. So, such is the case with these fulgurites. They're fulgurites. There's no question they're fulgurites. They're just massive fulgurites, the likes of which aren't seen anywhere else in the world that I know of. Not this size. So mainstream science ignores them. Also in this area are found tons of chunks and globules of a black slag material. And the top layer of sand in the area shows signs of once having melted together. Again, signs of tremendous heat that liquefied, vitrified the sand. Sand, of course, is made of silicate materials, which has a very high melting point. Many of you, I'm sure, are aware that, when they did their nuclear tests, as to what degree those nuclear tests were real, and something did go on at Los Alamos because huge swaths of land out there, are covered with vitrified sand, which turned an eerie green color. By the way, out in the Egyptian desert and in Libya as well, there are huge areas that have been known since ancient times. In fact, the Egyptians used to mine some of this material to make jewelry with. Libyan desert glass. It was once sand that vitrified. So there was a tremendous amount of heat in the Libyan desert that caused huge swaths of areas of sand to have been vitrified, as well as in parts of Egypt. The same has been found in the Gobi Desert. And these aren't from modern times. Again, this goes back to very ancient times. Anyway, you know, mainstream science will say, oh, well, perhaps there was a great impact of a meteorite in the air. Well, yeah, a meteorite, if large enough, would do that. Problem is, there's no crater associated with the Libyan desert glass or the, the Egyptian glass. There's no crater. What caused this heat? This layer in the Dead Sea area of this vitrified sand measures on average about half an inch thick. So the sand was melted down to a half an inch below the surface. That's a lot of heat. Also found in this area are tektites, which are usually believed to be of extraterrestrial origin. In some cases, I'm sure they are, especially when upon testing, some of them are found to be high in iridium, which is rare on Earth, but it's common in meteorites. But these tektite specimens from the Dead Sea area are not high in iridium. They appear to be of terrestrial, been created, by something that took place on Earth, not involving something from outer space. And again, when tektites are found, they're almost never found in association with vitrified layers of sand. We have this vitrified sand. We also have these vitrified buildings, right? So this is something out of the ordinary here, something very unusual. Anyway, the temperatures required to produce these tektites have been estimated to be well over 3,600 degrees Fahrenheit. So are we looking at a 4,000-year-old 9/11 beam weapons technology or some other type of tremendous heat-producing weapon? Well, first of all, guys, we know the ancient Greeks and some other cultures that borrowed this technology had a thing called Greek fire. And to this day, it's not really known what it was, what it was made of. They believe that bitumen was used, tar and oil. But the descriptions of the damage done by this weapon was, in fact, I have some notes I put together. At some point, I'll do a show on this Greek fire thing. Very interesting. But when you look at some of the ancient descriptions of the damage done by Greek fire, it goes beyond just mere bitumen or oil. This stuff was like napalm, if not worse. It incinerated everything in its path. It was deadly. It was feared. There were nations that would submit if threatened to have the Greek fire used on them. It was such a scary thing, such a devastating weapon. So, but, what we're looking at here produced even higher temperatures, much higher temperatures than what Greek fire was capable of. I just brought that up just to show that the ancients did have, very innovative, sinister weaponry capable of inflicting tremendous amount of destruction. But what we're talking about here in the Dead Sea area goes even way beyond that. We do know that the ancients did possess some incredible weaponry, and I'm going to be going into some of that later. I talked about this years ago back on Oracle. And like I said, I'm going to be repeating my show on catastrophism because in those set of notes, I do delve into ancient high technology dating back to the early catastrophic period, the early post-flood period. I believe that what that represented is a technology that was carried over from before this catastrophe. I believe early man did possess a very, very high technology. And I'll present evidence again to show that, for those who didn't hear that discussion the first time, I'll be presenting evidence that ancient man, far from being stupid and ape-like, like mainstream science would have you believe, ancient man actually had the potential for a greater mental capacity than what modern man possesses. So naturally, we shouldn't be surprised to see that they had higher technology than what we have. their brain capacity. Their brains were larger, right? The ancients were much larger in stature. Their brains were larger. The early atmosphere contained more oxygen. It's been shown that not only mankind, but just biological systems in general, function much more optimally under higher oxygen conditions. You know, and we know the early atmosphere did have more oxygen. Now, too much oxygen is toxic. We couldn't survive if we had too much. But no, the early atmosphere didn't have too much, but it did have more than what it does now. We have roughly today, I think, 21% air samples removed from ancient, you know, prehistoric samples of amber, which is fossilized tree sap. You know, air bubbles trapping ancient air that have been extracted and tested showed that the early prehistoric atmosphere contained about 32 to 33% oxygen. So not a deadly amount, but higher enough that, yeah, we now know that under conditions like that, people would have lived longer, would have grown to larger growth size. This has been demonstrated at Stanford University, for example. Tokyo University has also done experiments with this using, you know, biospheric chambers, hyperbaric chambers. So given that man had a larger brain size and lived to a longer age, would have meant much greater discoveries. Imagine someone like Tesla living to be several hundred years old and having a larger brain, having more brain capacity. Imagine the type of inventions that he could have produced living so much longer and having, you know, higher brain function. Imagine that. This is apparently what ancient man had. So the potential for him to have had higher technology than what we have today was much higher, right? Obviously. And we have evidence of this. I'll be looking at some of this later. I might not even get to it tonight. I'm rambling too much. So I might have to carry this into next week's show, but it's fascinating stuff. It's some of this I've covered years ago. For those that caught that show, you already know what I'm talking about. Some of you might have read up on this on your own. But there's a tremendous amount of ancient legendary evidence and physical evidence show that, yes, man did have a lot of high-tech inventions. Man had advanced weaponry, very deadly weaponry that would have produced the type of devastation that we see in the area. All right, guys, we'll break right back.
Embarrassed at being associated with the homo alt-right? At 25andhigh.com, we have a millennia of experience in changing names, all within our laws. Why be a Woodley when you can change to Weinstein and openly get away with sexually assaulting women and children? Scared of being a Gershom? Well, change to Greenspan, you schmuck. Print paper money out of thin air, charge interest, bam, set for life. How about Smith to Spectre and call for the genocide of an entire race? It's so simple. And a 25 Bitcoin transfer from you guarantees a new, clean Jewish identity. No more shame, guilt, or white privilege anxiety. 25andhigh.com. Be the changer you want to see.
right, guys, welcome back. So, here's the deal. Here's what I think happened. Now, as many of you know, I presented this in the past, that I don't believe that the Manhattan Project actually produced a nuclear weapon. I don't believe it one bit. I don't believe they had the technology in the 1940s to do what they did, just like I don't believe they had the technology in 1969 to land on the frickin' moon, or in 1970 or 71 or 72. They don't have it now. However, as to whether or not that technology exists now, you know, for nuclear weapons is anybody's guess. I do believe there's such thing as nuclear weapons. I know they didn't have that technology in 1945. Have they developed it since? Quite possibly. But I know that they had it in ancient times. And as I've said before, I believe, for very good reason, that they were hoping to rediscover what the ancients had stumbled upon, because they were using the Mahabharata and other ancient Indian texts as a guide. And don't forget, guys, I've said this before, only about 10% of the Mahabharata has ever been translated and released to the public. The other 90% has been squelched to this day. It's not even known what the hell's in there. They won't release it to the public. So you can bet your fat fanny that they had the entire text available, which probably goes into very exquisite detail. In fact, how do you think they went from not even knowing what the hell an atom was in 1900 to being able to describe the inward workings of it? If not to be able to exploit it, they at least understood that this power existed inside the atom. How the hell did they know this? Because it's all laid out in the Mahabharata. What has been released and translated is very revealing. And we'll be looking at some quotes from that shortly here. What I think happened is our little tribal bastard friends got a hold of one of these weapons, guys, and unleashed it upon the cities of the Dead Sea area. And to this day, that area, not just because this high salt content in the Dead Sea itself, but even besides that, that area would be a dead area to this day because it was so thoroughly devastated in ancient times. It's never recovered. It's a barren wasteland. And I think our little friend Abraham played a key role in it. But anyways, you know, with that all aside, let's look at the evidence. From around the world, we have records of tremendous weapons that existed that could inflict powerful devastation on the target, enemy target of these weapons. But the most astonishing records that go into the most exquisite details that we have that survived to our day are from India, particularly the Mahabharata, which is believed to have been penned about 4,000 years ago. But it relates events that were ancient at that time, events that date back probably 5,000, 6,000 years at least. This ancient document, and there's others too, there's the Ramayana and a few others, but the Mahabharata is the most detailed. And like I said, guys, it's so detailed that they've only released 10% of it. Yeah, I guarantee you it goes into a hell of a lot more detail that they will never release to the public. Probably describes how to make such a weapon. But, and even though it does do that, I just don't think in 1945 they were capable of doing it. They made a go at it. I think they really wanted to do it, thought they could do it. They couldn't. So they faked it, just like Apollo. I think originally, when Kennedy laid out that plan and, you know, in his national address speech, I think they wanted to. I'm sure he wanted to. And I believe NASA wanted to and thought they could and made an honest go at it. But by the time the mid-60s rolled around and they had so many problems, and, you know, monkeys returning dead, they realized, oh, crap, we're not going to be able to do it. So they just faked it. I think the same thing happened in 1969 that happened in 1945, guys. They just faked it. Have they developed the technology since then? Well, have they developed the technology to land on the moon since then? No. Oh, we'd be there by now, wouldn't we? No, they haven't. They're working on it, and it's feasible that they'll be able to do it. The one idea that's been suggested, I think that's the most logical and reasonable method is to create a powerful magnetic field around a spacecraft that would divert the harmful radiation of the Van Allen belts away from the craft, just like the Earth's magnetic field does. That's probably the only way they're going to be able to do it. They can't do it by encasing a rocket in lead. You'd have to do it, you know, you have to have 6 feet thick of lead to block out that radiation. It's that bad. It's that powerful. So the idea of a magnetic field seems much more feasible. But obviously, they haven't even done it yet, guys. They're talking about it. They're working on it, but they haven't perfected it yet. So have they perfected nuclear weapons? We know that the ancients had them, the evidence of which we'll be looking at in a moment here, and the evidence of which exists over in the Dead Sea and several other places, too. Did you know that there's vitrified stone forts in Scotland? Did you know that? Google that. Look that up. There's pictures of them and everything. It's unbelievable, guys. They're thousands of years old. They don't even know how old they are, but they know that they're very, very ancient. And there's no explanation, not from mainstream science anyway, that can account for what type of heat could have possibly caused these stones to drip and melt and fuse together. But we can know what it is once we step outside the box and start looking at ancient documents like the Mahabharata, which tell us how this was done. The Mahabharata describes, for example, an 18-day war between two rival factions, the Kauravas and the Pandavas, who inhabited the upper regions of the Ganges. Probably the predecessors of Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa. In fact, some of the ruins in that area were found to be vitrified. They even found some skeletons going way back to the early, early days of Mahabharata, or perhaps even the period preceding those cities, going back probably 4,000 or 5,000 years. But they found skeletal remains that were scattered about in the streets, and they were burnt to a crisp. Bones that were found burnt to a crisp, and the skeletons were laid about haphazardly. In fact, some of these bones were found to be radioactive, even after all these millennia, still giving off radioactive decay. Imagine that, guys. Anyway, not long after this war described in the Mahabharata, a second war was waged against the Vrishnis and the Andakas in the same region. In both conflicts, Vamanas, described in this particular text as celestial cars and aerial chariots with sides of iron clad with wings, were used to launch a weapon of terrible destructive power. This weapon was known as the Ignaya weapon. I'd be interested to know that in modern times, when India did their first nuclear tests, they called it the Ignaya Project. They named it after this ancient weapon. And let me remind you, Mr. Oppenheimer was a big fan of the Mahabharata. He was a Sanskrit scholar. And when asked, how does it feel to be a part of the scientific team to develop the first nuclear weapon, or if they in fact did that, or to have worked on developing one anyway? You know what he said? Well, the first one in modern times anyway. He actually said that, meaning that he knew the ancients had worked on and in fact had developed such a weapon. The first one in modern times, after the bombs were dropped, and I'll argue they weren't atomic bombs, they were just carpet bombs of conventional weapons, conventional bombs. But in any case, it doesn't matter. He made the comment when asked, you know, to give his remarks about the devastating power of the supposed nuclear bombs. You know what he said, or atomic bombs. You know what he said? He quoted from the Mahabharata and said, "I have become the destroyer of worlds." So you think all this is chance? No, it isn't. He, along with all the other attendees at the Manhattan Project meetings, at the time, they were top secret meetings. They were reading from this ancient text, parts of, the other 90% that we've never seen and probably never will see. When John Kerry told, Tim Russert. Oh, yeah, Tim, there's all kinds of secrets. This is one of those secrets he was talking about, ladies and gentlemen. Anyway, the first of these two wars that were fought in these aircraft called Vimana is described in the Mahabharata as follows. It says, the valiant Adwatan, remaining steadfast in his Vimana. By the way, Vimanas are described as iron birds that spit fire upon taking off. And they made a roaring sound as like a lion. What does that sound like? Modern jet aircraft, right? Anyway, it says, the valiant Adwatan, remaining steadfast in his Vimana, landed upon the water and from there unleashed the Ignaya weapon, incapable of being resisted by the very gods. Taking careful aim against his foes, he let loose the blazing missile of smokeless fire with tremendous force. Smokeless fire. Please understand that when this part of the Mahabharata was translated and released to the public, it was done in the mid-19th century. So nobody can say that this was being flavored with a modern understanding of nuclear physics. No. Missile of smokeless fire with tremendous force, it says. Dense arrows of flame like a great shower issued forth upon creation, encompassing the enemy. Meteors flashed down from the sky, or streaks of flaming material. A thick gloom quickly settled upon the Pandava hosts. All points of the compass were lost in darkness. Fierce winds began to blow. Clouds roared upward, showering dust and gravel. Birds croaked madly, and beasts shuddered from the destruction. The very elements seemed disturbed. The sun seemed to waver in the heavens. The earth shook, scorched by the terrible, violent heat of this weapon. Guys, you can't make this stuff up, man. This is way too detailed. Elephants burst into flame and ran to and fro in a frenzy, seeking protection from the terror. This isn't some fanciful work of fiction, guys. This is a scientific description of a powerful weapon unleashed in ancient times. Over a vast area, other animals crumpled to the ground and died. The waters boiled, and the creatures residing in them also died. From all points of the compass, the arrows of flame rained continuously and fiercely. The missile of Adwatan burst with the power of thunder, and the hostile warriors collapsed like trees burnt in a raging fire. Thousands of war vehicles fell down on all sides. You have got to be kidding me. So, again, my position is, this is what happened at the Dead Sea that liquefied, vaporized, vitrified these ancient stone buildings of these five cities in an instant with a tremendous amount of heat that created, you know, those fulgurites that are the size of tree trunks. Don't forget, fulgurites created by lightning are small, usually the thickness of your finger and only a few feet long, not 8, 10, 12 feet long and a foot to a foot and a half or even 2 feet wide. This is a tremendous disaster. 5-kilometer crater in the area. Balls of sulfur found everywhere. Everywhere. One of the videos on YouTube, this guy is just walking along and he's like, look at everywhere you look, you see balls of sulfur. We're told that, you know, sulfur rained from the sky, right? And so this, here it is. And the buildings have been there. That's what amazed me the most. The buildings have been there all along. You don't have to dive into the depths of the Dead Sea. It's not there. It's not in the Dead Sea. It's all around the Dead Sea. They've been there all along. No one saw them because they interpreted these structures as natural formations. No, they're not. Anyway, the Mahabharata goes on to describe a second battle of this nature. It says, Gurkha, flying in his swift and powerful Vimana, hurled against the three cities of the Vishnis and the Advakas, a single projectile charged with all the power of the universe. An incandescent column, listen to this, an incandescent column of smoke and fire, as brilliant as 10,000 suns, rose in all of its splendor. The brilliance of 10,000 suns, an incandescent column of smoke and fire? You can't make this up. It was the unknown weapon, the iron thunderbolt, a gigantic messenger of death, which reduced to ashes the entire race of the Vrishnis and the Andvakas. Did you catch that, guys? It reduced these two civilizations to what? To ashes. What do we see in the Dead Sea area? Ash. We see ancient buildings that were encrusted in very, very hot ash that vitrified the stones, that turned sulfur to white, the hottest temperature that sulfur can attain and still be recognized as sulfur. The corpses were so burnt that they were no longer recognizable. Hair and nails fell out. Pottery broke without cause. Birds disturbed, circled in the air, and were turned white. Foodstuffs were poison. Isn't this exactly what we would expect from nuclear fallout? Every single detail. To escape, the warriors threw themselves in streams to wash themselves and their equipment from the poison ray. Oh, wow. Wow, wow. That's what they'll tell you guys in case of nuclear fallout. The first thing you do is wash off those radioactive particles, right? On a similar note, another ancient Indian text, the Ramayana, which I mentioned before, states that when the god Rama was threatened by an army of monkeys, he put a magic arrow into action. Now here's, like I was saying before, where ancient legends sometimes are flavored with hyperbole or exaggerated, you know, blah, blah, blah. But if you can get past the monkey thing, there's elements of truth here as well. This produced, it says, a flash of lightning, quote, stronger than the heat from 100,000 suns turning everything to dust. It produced what? A flash of lightning. A very powerful flash of lightning. With the power of 100,000 suns, don't you think that kind of lightning would be capable of producing fulgurites 8, 10, 12 feet long and 2 feet wide? Yeah, absolutely. The description here in this ancient Indian document describes the very type of devastation we see in the Dead Sea area, guys. Freaking fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. In fact, what else could have created the types of things that we see in that area? Nothing natural that we know of. The document then went on to say that the hair of survivors fell out, and that their nails disintegrated. Again, just what you would expect from nuclear fallout, guys. People get radiation treatments. What happens? The hair falls out, right? Once again, Robert Oppenheimer, the father of the atomic bomb, so we're told, was indeed a Sanskrit scholar. How do you like that, guys? On July 16, 1945, when asked about tests conducted near Alamogordo in New Mexico, he quoted from the Mahabharata saying, "I have unleashed the power of the universe. Now I have become the destroyer of worlds," as I mentioned before. He quoted from the Mahabharata. He didn't even say he was doing that. But that's exactly what he was doing. Guys, they had the Mahabharata right there at their disposal. They used it as their blueprint. They were especially reading from that 90% that's never been released to the public. You see how much we're BS'd, how much we're lied to? And you see how most of their lies are lies of omission. Oh, yes, they lie in what they tell us, too. But their lies mostly consist in what they're not telling us, leaving out key pieces of information so we miss the big picture. Anyway. When asked during an interview at Rochester University several years after the first alleged atomic test whether it was the first such bomb ever, oh, here it is right here, he said, well, yes, in modern history, the first time such a bomb was unleashed, the first time in modern history. How do you like that, guys? Precisely in the area where these conflicts are reported to have taken place, in India, in the Ganges region, near Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro, like I said before, archaeologists have discovered numerous burnt ruins, vitrified ruins, which have yet to be fully explored, excavated, but they have found human remains that were charred and were still mildly radioactive, registered on the Geiger counter. The stones are vitrified, melted together, just like what I described, in Scotland. Some ruins have been found in Baghdad. One is believed to have been an ancient ziggurat, and some of the stones are melted together. You can see where the material dripped and caused stones to be fused together. We see the same thing again in the Dead Sea area, guys. No, they're not cliffs. They're not buttes. They're ancient structures. And, I mentioned, too, how these indented rectangular features that obviously were once windows and doors, that is indicative of them being buildings. And, the fact that some of them have little towers and other projections that look of human origin. But the very way these buildings are arranged, too, often they're in straight rows, indicating that, they were once on the edge of walkways, of streets. So the very arrangement of these structures, not just how they look individually, but the way that they're arranged shows that they were once part of a city structure. The observations that have thus far been made in the area of the Ganges indicate that the ruins there that, show signs of vitrification were not burned by any ordinary fire. No ordinary fire would melt stone, ladies and gentlemen. In fact, no natural burning flame or volcanic eruption could ever have produced the type of phenomenon observed in these ruins. Not just common fires, but even volcanic eruptions wouldn't do this. No sign of any volcano in the area. There's no volcanic ash or lava or, Only the heat released through atomic energy could have produced these kind of effects. In these same ruins, there have also been found charred uh, pottery, you know, that shows signs of having been broken into in pieces and scattered from the heat. Just like the Mahabharata described, pottery burst, it said, from the heat. Speaking on this matter, Australian researcher Jonathan Gray had this to say. He's a pretty interesting guy. It turns out he's a frickin' Seventh-day Adventist, but I can forgive him for that because he's written some pretty good books. Dead Men's Secrets is one where he goes into a lot of detail about ancient technology. It's pretty good stuff. Anyway, here's what he wrote. In fact, I think this is from that book, Dead Men's Secrets. He says, skeletons in Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa are extremely radioactive. Well, I don't know how extreme, but the fact that they're radioactive at all, tells us something. The ruins of these ancient Indus Valley cities are immense. They are thought to have contained well over a million people each. Practically nothing is known of their histories, except that both were destroyed suddenly. In Mohenjo-Daro, this is kind of tricky because Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa underwent two different destructions. One was in more recent times at the close of the Bronze Age, which I've mentioned before. You know, the tribe had their hand in that, but there's also a more ancient layer. The Proto-Harappians and the Proto-Mohenjo-Darans, which show sign of tremendous heat. So when he talks about this, I think he's apparently referring to the first destruction, the more ancient one. But understand, it underwent another destruction. So, you know, what do we have there? The tribe returning to the scene of their earlier crime to wreak vengeance again on a later generation. How far back does the tribe go, guys? Well, you know, I've only been able to trace them back to the fifth millennium. You know, the 2000s BC, but who knows, guys? Who knows about that? Anyway, that's all we're getting right now. Finish this up tomorrow, guys, and we all have some more stuff. Have a great week. We'll see you next week. Take care.
Personal care products? Do you even know what those chemicals are? You should. Everything you put onto your body ends up getting into your body, so you better be sure that you are using quality products every day. We know it's often hard to find really good natural products, and when you do find them, they're often very expensive. That's why we have Heathen Herbs. Give us a try. We have affordable herbal tinctures, tooth powder, deodorant, muscle salves, creams, beeswax, cling wrap, gift baskets, magnesium, iodine, throat spray, face spray, hairspray, cleaning spray, bug spray, linen spray, and so much more. We're coming out with new products all the time so that you can replace all the corporate crap. Use coupon code RENEGADE for 10% off everything at heathenherbs.com.